Coming up next, an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Les Gelb. Next on The Dusty Wright Show at CultureCatch.com. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at Sony Pro. What's in your HDNA? Visit them at pro.sony.com. Joining me today on The Dusty Wright Show, we're very honored to have a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Les Gelb. Les, congratulations on your book, Power Rules.
Good to be here.
Common sense. It seems that we need a lot of that today.
I know. It's in short supply. It used to be the dominant feature of American life. We were known for our common sense, our pragmatism, our problem solving. Now a lot of that is gone. And, you know, there's an interesting way we were reminded of this quite recently. You remember that airline pilot who made that emergency landing in the Hudson River, Sully Sullenberger?
Yes.
Well, the nation went crazy over what he did. What did he do? He said, I can't fly to the Teterboro Airport. I've got to put it down in the Hudson River, and I got to put it down at this speed, at this angle, and so forth. He did it. All the lives were saved. And Americans thought this was fantastic. And what they were really celebrating was his competence, which used to be, you know, normal, everyday thing. It had become so unusual that he was now a hero.
Right. Very, very good point. I like that. Which belies the basic premise of your book, succeed together or fail apart. I mean, it seems so simple, yet so foreign to everything that seems to be governing politics, the economy, the environment. We seem to have gotten off course so spread thin by so many special interest groups.
Right. You have to be very dumb not to understand that in international affairs, it's succeed together, fail apart. And yet, we have to learn it in every single issue, every single time, all over again. You would think Americans would be quite cooperative, but we don't like to do it. We prefer to tell others what to do rather than to lead in a way that expresses our power, but also takes their interest into account. It's become a hardship for us, and particularly in the last 20 years.
Why do you think we have such arrogance towards that?
Well, as I say in the book, I hate to mention the book.
No, please do. We love hearing it.
As I say in the book, you know, I think if you start out with a lot of these problems, then most of us would agree pretty quickly on what we can do and what we can't do with our power. And then shortly, the demons take over, what I call the demons. One is the demon of principle, that, you know, we've got to transform the world, fix all the human rights problems, make every country a democratic free market paradise. So principles take over, and you can't be against those principles. Second is domestic politics, where, you know, people will accuse you of giving things away, of a defeatist attitude, and you don't want to put yourself in a position of being criticized. And the third demon is the arrogance of power, which is the belief, well, you know, we Americans can do anything if we make up our minds to do it, if we have the will.
Right. And this opens a bigger issue, concern, I guess, for many Americans. It's like, where do you go for the news? Where do you go to, you know, we seem to be so spread so thin. When I was growing up as a young man in the 60s and 70s, we had three distinct news channels. You got your news from them. Now we have so many choices, so many of them. Are
what were those three?
CBS, NBC, and ABC.
Oh, the TV, you're saying?
TV, right. Oh. Okay, all right. When we get into the other media, okay. You know, growing up in Ohio, of course, you know, I went to the New York Times, as many of us did in our neighborhood. And then we had the local paper, which was owned by Knight Ritter, the Akron Beacon Journal. So you kind of went there for your local news. And if you wanted national news, you know, you went to Washington and New York. But I mean, today, young people have so many choices. I wonder if they just are switching off because they have too many options. Will they find a book like this that is so common sense? It is like, you know, it's not a textbook. It's just a book about setting things straight.
That's the way I look at it. And the odd thing is that common sense becomes such a radical notion because we're so far from it in so many instances. You just think of the way we've thought about and handled some crises. If we go back to the Arab oil boycott of 1973, we've known since then that we had to reduce our dependence on Middle East oil.
Right.
I didn't know a single person who disagreed with that proposition and that it was critical for us to lower that dependence. Otherwise, we'd find ourselves in one Middle Eastern war after another. But we did nothing from then until now. It's really quite incredible. Where's the common sense? Or you take North Korea. Everyone says, well, we're going to get tough with the North Koreans. They have nuclear weapons and they're testing missiles and we can't put up with it. We won't tolerate it. What the devil do they want to do? They want to go bomb North Korea to smithereens? The biggest obstacle to taking any military action against North Korea is South Korea.
Right.
Because if we attack the North, South Korea would get destroyed in the process. They're the last ones who want us to use the military force. So you have to start from that reality. And your policy has to be based on the fact that maybe in some extreme case, we'd have to go after the North. But to make that the basis of how we deal with them, it's preposterous. And what's more, they don't believe it.
Right.
And Bush made threats for 8 years. They ignored him. And they developed a nuclear capability. And we lost our credibility, which is the basis of our power.
And now we're trying to restore the credibility. It was amazing to me to see how Barack was embraced before he was even elected. Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't, because I think people had it with George Bush. He wasn't a real conservative. He was kind of a know-nothing. Real conservative Americans are quite responsive to.
Right. Where do we go moving forward? Has Obama bitten off more than he can chew with trying to lay out too many platforms at once? Should he just be focused on one or two key items?
See, that's what I think. I think he really has to prioritize because you haven't got the power to bring it all home.
Right.
And you need real experience with management and with making government work to know that, to understand it. And for as smart as Obama is, and boy, is he smart, he hasn't had that kind of experience. Now, he also has a different philosophy. He says, hey, I'm popular now. I'm going to take advantage of it, and I'm going to get all the hard things in under the rug as quickly as possible. And that's the approach he's taken. I don't think it's the right one, but I wish him well, unlike Rush Limbaugh.
Now, you brought up something very fascinating about, and I don't think most Americans realize, they hear the word lobbyist thrown around, battered about, but they don't realize the influence peddling that happens. Now, Barack said he was going to try to cut that at the knees, the influence peddling. Mm-hmm. I loved your story. I was fascinated to learn how Nixon and Kissinger were able to submarine their efforts when they laid the groundwork for their forays into China. How is Barack handling the lobbyists, and how would you handle them in a common sense way?
Yeah, well, the lobbyists are part of our democracy, and they're a pain in the neck because the lobbyists exercise influence way disproportionate to their numbers, and I think to the common good. We see this with the gun lobby or the older people on Social Security questions or the Jewish community or Cuban American community on those foreign issues, you take them on only when you're ready to do something consequential.
Right.
You don't fight those battles before you have to, and when you have to, you get tough about it, and you should, because I think the bulk of the American people will be with you.
Has Barack had success in maybe taking on some of the more hard-lined lobbyists in his first 100 days? Or has he not really even seen the tip of the iceberg yet?
I don't think he's seen very much of it because it looks like he's made the hard decisions, but I think he's just operated along the peaks of the mountain so far.
Right.
And as they get into the actual legislation and implementation, you'll see the problems. For example, He announced the plan to deal with derivatives.
Right.
But But it turns out he wasn't going to deal with a certain class of derivatives, which is what most of the bankers use. And there are no enforcement mechanisms. So he hasn't faced the tough issues yet.
Right. And how about the tough issue? 2 days ago, we learned that General McKiernan had been replaced by Lieutenant General McChrystal in Afghanistan. They needed a tougher position. Is that a war we can even win? Didn't we learn anything common sense-wise? The Russians couldn't do it. Why should we think we could or can?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that this is a war that we can win. I think it's a war that the Afghans can win with our help.
Right.
And the sooner we put them in a position to do that and remove ourselves from the combat end of this, the better. And then in the end, it has to be up to them. In all these kinds of internal revolutions, civil wars, upheavals, outsiders can't win it for them.
Right.
Only the people who we care about, the moderates in these countries, can win it for themselves. But they've got to fight. And they've got to make their governments work. They've got to provide goods and services to their people. They've got to be honest. They can't be corrupt. And unfortunately, our friends in too many of these places are corrupt and highly inefficient. And there's no amount of American input or blood that will let us win in those circumstances.
Now, you made, I was reading online, your stance on Iran. You feel in 10 years, there's enough of middle class that they'll be our strongest ally.
I do. Iran is in balance now between the mullahs who are on top.
Right.
And the bazaaris, the commercial class, the middle class. And you'll notice that for all our talk about how the mullahs dominate everything, the fact is the opposition is still very much there. They get elected to parliament. Often they win majorities in various councils inside Iran. You have leaders like Rafsanjani and Hatami, we call moderates, still around because the bad guys can't get rid of them.
Right.
They are part of the power structure. We've got to help them without doing it blatantly. We've got to help them by putting good carrots and sticks on the table that will enable them to improve their position internally.
And a lot of this, doesn't common sense would just say, you have to know the culture you're dealing with. You can't force the will of American culture, even though we're a melting pot and we've absorbed a lot of these cultures. But politically speaking, they have a different way of operating, common sense would say, you know.
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the great paradoxes of American foreign policy. Here we are, a nation of immigrants that knows less about the world than almost any other country in the world. It makes no sense. And you can't run a foreign policy effectively without knowing the societies and the politics you're dealing with.
Right.
What buttons do you push? Right. We often flail around with our power because we don't know which buttons to push, and we don't know how what we do will have what kind of effects in different societies.
You know, I've wondered if Obama's his national service program would help break that arrogance that we have. 80% of Americans don't have passports, allegedly. 23% in government don't. Uh-huh. You know, they haven't traveled even to a third world country as simple as something in the West Indies to see how others
live.
Yeah,
a lot of them don't know.
They don't know. So maybe that would help. You know, we had kids serving in the military or being in the Peace Corps or something. Would that help stem, you know, the tide of this arrogance?
I think it would help. You know, my last job with the New York Times was as the foreign affairs columnist, and I traveled around, and this is at the end of the Cold War.
Right.
And as I went from country to country, the people who really knew a lot were not our CIA analysts or the professors in the universities, but Americans who worked for non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, who were living in those countries, working on refugee problems or humanitarian, human. You know, there is a problem with the bloggers. So many of them are ideological.
Right.
And they're more interested in their opinions, their point of view, than they are the facts.
Right.
And journalism is supposed to be trying to find out what the facts are. Can't do it all the time, but that's the charge. That's what you're supposed to do.
There's an old, I want to get your take on this and how it applies to much of what you've written and your power rules. And I would encourage those listening to this to really pick it up. It's a terrific read. Thank you for enlightening us with this common sense. There's an old Iroquois maxim, and allegedly some of our forefathers used it to frame the Constitution. Do you know this? In our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations. And I think it's a wonderful maxim. I don't know if it's feasible for our leaders. I mean, as you said, 1973, we knew there was a problem with the oil reserve. We knew back then about the ecology. You know, are we so Pollyanna that we can't get out of our own ways? Are we so...
Well, that's the ultimate question. And it's how I end the book, really, by going through just the arguments we've gone through here and saying, by and large, the people who control the demons take over the policy, and the moderates just sit there. We can't afford that anymore. Right. Our margin for error is too small. And the moderates have to do an unmoderate thing. They have to fight. They have to organize politically and take on the extremes and get the problem solved the way we used to.
Absolutely. Do we need a third party?
I don't know.
A moderate party?
I don't know.
Just be partisanship. Be into the partisanship.
Yeah, you have to get political because that's where the decisions are made. And your generation, I believe, has the leaders. They just have to go out and fight. People have to realize that unless they do, they're going to be living in a country that they might not be proud of.
Good point. Les, I know you have other people calling you. I want to thank you for your time on the Dusty Wright Show.
Enjoyed it.
Continued success. We hope that this is a bestseller before you know it, and that there's a sequel, and that many of the people listening to this might be writing it.
Well, there won't be a sequel, but I hope it's a bestseller.
Cheers. I'd like to thank my guest, Mr. Les Gehl. And of course, as always, my editor, Mr. Julian Siegler. This is Dusty Wright for the Dusty Wright Show. If you like our programming, please leave your comments for us in the iTunes directory and check culturecatch.com daily for all of your smart culture needs in all areas of the arts. Remember, converge is the word.
Influencing the influencers. Smart culture. CultureCatch.com